What are we doing?
No, it's okay. Just listen. This is important. Okay? Just sit and chill. Chill in the sound. So, let me take you back to the year 1934. You're a young black musician, incredibly gifted and hardworking. You've worked your whole life in the pursuit of music, and you know you'll continue on that path until the day you die. But you're not a jazz musician. You're a classical pianist. Billy Strayhorn was a phenomenal jazz musician, composer, arranger, known primarily for his close collaboration with Duke Ellington over nearly three decades. People who know jazz, which is not me, know him from the Duke Ellington Orchestra's theme song, Take the A-Train. But what a lot of people don't know is that he was trained classically as soon as he could get his hands on a piano, and he fully intended to make a career as a classical pianist. In the year 1934, at the age of 19, Billy performed the Grieg Piano Concerto in A minor at his high school graduation. His high school music director commented more than 50 years afterwards, "I never heard a student play that way before or after. The orchestra may have been a group of students, but Billy Strayhorn was a professional artist." So why do we know him from jazz? Well, Billy's friend Harry Herforth said, "Billy looked into colleges but was discouraged because of his race and could not get the necessary financial aid. The very idea of a black concert pianist was considered unthinkable. It had nothing to do with Billy's considerable talent." Today, we're going to be talking about Billy's life and legacy and what it tells us about the divisions of race, class, and accessibility in music then and now.
If you want to find out about classical queers, then you're in the right place with Alice and Jaheed.
Yeah! This is Classical Queeros, a podcast that aims to queer up the classical space by highlighting the voices of queer composers that history forgot. My name is Alice Park. My pronouns are she, her. I am a flute player and a cat mom, and I love butter cake from California Pizza Kitchen.
Butter cake?
Yeah.
What comprises butter cake?
I don't know why it's called butter cake, because it's not just like, you know how, like, as a child, you're like, cheesecake is cake made out of cheese, and it's not? It's kind of like the same thing. It's not cake made out of butter. It's just, like, really good cake, but it's closer to like a really sweet bread than a cake in like consistency. But it's so good, and it melts in your mouth, and
That's what I was imagining, like a sweet loaf.
Yeah, a sweet loaf, just like Rosie.
Rosie is a sweet loaf. She's our queen.
Yeah.
we will all worship her.
Yeah, we do. Wait, what is your name? Introduce yourself.
Oh, my name is Shahid. Pronouns he, him, his. I am a flute player. A wish to be cat mom. I am not, because my apartment does not allow pets. And I am really terrible at keeping plants alive.
Oh my god, same.
Oh, no. I've tried so hard with so many. I am currently looking at my snake plant, which is like very droopy, and the ends are dried, and there's probably like several reasons why this happened. It's like probably one of the easier ones to take care of too, and it's not looking so well. Aww. So
you know what, it's okay. Some of us just aren't meant for this, but I believe that like you'll find the right plants, you know.
The right plants for me are definitely the fake ones at IKEA.
You gotta do what you gotta do.
I
get flowers for Sam regularly when I go to Trader Joe's. You know, just like any kind of flowers. And they always die so quickly. Like, roses I know die quickly, like, anyway. Like, it kind of doesn't matter what you do. But all other flowers, succulents, like, I kill succulents. And you're not supposed to be able to do that. So,
if you're listening to us and you're good at plants, please send us plant tips.
Yeah, send us plant tips, because we're hopeless.
Hashtag plant tips.
Hashtag queeros plant tips. Oh my gosh. Okay, so I'm super excited to talk about Billy Strayhorn. As you heard by my masterfully crafted introduction, I have to say I was really proud of that.
That was very good.
Thank you. But first, before we do that, we have our iconic opening segment, What Do You Say, Gay?
Oh, so, yeah.
Heck yeah. So our question for today is, if you could go back in time and tell your baby gay self any one piece of advice, what would it be?
I think about this so often. I'm always like, wow, I wish I could go back in time and tell myself not to do that stupid thing I just did. Or like that stupid thing I did 3 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of it would have to be kind of like decisions I made. Like, although I kind of like to live, I like to think about like no regrets and like everything is for a reason. Yeah. And like I'm here because of all the decisions I've made and I'm very happy with where I am.
Uh-huh.
But I also can't help but feel that there's always like those other like missed opportunities.
Yeah.
So like, for example, when I was in high school, when I was going to high school, I went to an art school, and I like regretted it very quickly.
Mm.
And I went back to my public school, which had like a very strong like music program.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, if I had just done that from the beginning,
it's like, yeah,
wouldn't have wasted so much energy on that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So like little things like that, or like, I wish I had applied to a different arts high school where I feel like I would have had more opportunity. And yeah, things like that, I think, are mostly things I think about a lot.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. But that sounds like good advice.
Yeah. I'm happy with what I did. But it also is like, also like, okay, one day I'm going to have kids and I'm going to like be able to guide them better than I
That's true.
I guided myself.
Yeah. For me, you know, I came up with this question and I don't know what my answer is really, but I guess I would say that if I could go back to my baby gay self, I would tell her that like, it's okay that there's not a lot of people like me or you or her or whatever. And I would say like, it's okay to feel lonely, but also remember that you do have a bunch of friends, even though they're different from you, even though they're straight and whatever. And your sexuality is not your entire identity. And that someday, like, you won't feel this particular kind of loneliness and it will be okay. So just, like, focus on, like, being, like you in all of your, in, like, you know, have a, like, a well-rounded personality and not just, like, gay, which is, like, you know, fun. And I feel like I did that okay, but I still felt, like, sad about a lot of stuff as a baby gay. So I would tell her to, like, chill, basically, is my answer. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's very sweet. I love it.
Thank you.
I think we all needed to chill as baby gays.
Yeah. Yeah, truly, fully, just chill. And, like, yeah. Do you like, I know that our listeners can't see this, but do you like my lesbian pride flag scarf hanging in the background?
Yes, I was looking at it. It's so beautiful with like the glow coming through the window.
Yeah, it's, yeah, I like this. I never wear it because I never have a reason to wear scarves really. And it doesn't really go with much of my clothes, but I like knowing that I have it.
It's really, it looks great there, honestly.
Yeah, maybe I'll just leave it. I brought it to, like, wrap up the microphone and stuff.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it looks awesome. It looks like it's, like, adding, like, lights that is, like, pink.
Yeah, it's pink. Nice. I like it.
Yeah.
Anyway, we're going to take a break. And then after, we're going to talk about Billy Strayhorn.
If you want to find out about classical queers, then you're in the right place with Alice and Jahid.
And we're back.
Yeah.
Yay. So, Billy Strayhorn, he is a jazz dude, and I understand that our Classical Queeros podcast is about classical composers, but I feel like it's okay to do him today, because he started out as a classical musician with classical training, but he was kept out of the world of classical music because of racism, because nobody could think of, like, allowing a black concert pianist to prosper. So we were denied a critical phenomenal voice in the field of classical music. And fortunately, he was able to thrive as much as he could in jazz. But if classical music were just a little bit better at being less terrible, then, he would have been in classical music, and he was phenomenal. He's really good. So that's why we're doing him today, even though it's about jazz. And so, listeners, you'll have to just bear with me as we go through this, because I don't know anything about jazz. So if I say something that doesn't make sense because I'm reading it wrong, I did my best. Just bear with me. I'm trying.
Love you, jazzers.
Yeah. So, okay. So Billy Strayhorn was born on November 29th, 1915. He wasn't, his parents didn't even name him when he was born because many of their previous babies had died very quickly. So they didn't name him. The name William was officially added to his birth certificate when he was 10 or 12.
Wow.
Uh-huh. So
that's really sad.
Yeah, very sad. He moved around a lot as a kid, but mostly pretty much he grew up in Pittsburgh. This neighborhood was integrated, but not because of a love of diversity. No. This was because white landlords wanted to continue to rent out dilapidated properties, but they didn't want to deal with the upkeep. So they just left it disgusting and were like, all right, black folks, you can live here. And that's how the neighborhood got integrated.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, he had a lot of siblings and an alcoholic father in a tiny house. So he largely he kept to himself. He loved his mom and he spent a lot of time with her and just adored her. And he also spent months at a time living with his grandparents and walking through fields of flowers and just happy and being alone and stuff. As a kid, he ended up with a job as a pharmacy delivery boy, and he worked enough hours to buy himself a piano. So wow. Here's a quote from a book called Lush Life, which is a biography about Billy Strayhorn. Most of the material I got for this episode is from that book. It's a great book. This quote is from Billy himself. He said, "Of course, during all this time, I was going to grade school and selling papers as well. So I finally bought myself a piano and started to play it. I started to study, and the more I learned, the more I wanted to learn. My family was kind of large and so couldn't indulge me in all my wishes, so I had to do this for myself. It wasn't all that easy, but I guess if you want something hard enough, it just gets done. Directly, I got that piano." So already he's a hard worker, baby. Yeah. Billy Strayhorn is out here doing what he's got to do to get himself a piano, and it's great. In his music program in high school, he was clearly the best one there. Here's another quote about the music program. In 1927, Carl McVicker, a young Carnegie Tech graduate, joined the Westinghouse, that's the high school, faculty as an instrumental music teacher and instituted a music program considered so radical that two teachers left the school over it. He accepted and encouraged students of all backgrounds and races to play all instruments. That's the radical program.
Wow.
Yeah. One of his students said, "Mr. McVicker instilled self-respect in those of us who were his students because he respected us regardless of our background." And so Billy Strayhorn was a black kid in an integrated neighborhood, and he was gay. So, and also this was the 30s in Pittsburgh. So you'd think that he would just be alone and beaten up all the time. But no, he had friends. He did have friends. He hung out with people, mostly people he would just make music with. But it's not growing up that was easy, because he did seem different. He did seem more feminine, less typically macho and masculine. One of his friends, Mickey Scrima, said, "He had a hard time. It's no wonder he was timid. He was in a shell. You gotta remember, those Pittsburghers were tough. How can I say this? He had a hard time making friends. To tell you the truth, people used to call him a sissy. That's what everybody said. The thing is, he had bigger fish to fry. All he did day and night was concentrate on the only thing he cared about, the one thing he wanted, to go on doing what he did on the day of our graduation, be a classical concert pianist."
Mm.
So, yeah, he was not alone, but he had a goal, and he was on his way. He started taking lessons with a prominent teacher in the Pittsburgh black community, and he was working constantly. And as I mentioned before, at his high school graduation, he performed the Grieg Piano Concerto in A minor. He also, for this same performance, wrote a concerto for percussion and piano, which was inspired by Gershwin-esque rhythms. And so he performed both of those, I believe, that day. So wow. He's just like the best of the best at this point.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. He's like a star. He knew everything. People would say, like, you know, he would just start sit down at a piano and start playing things. And people always thought that he just like was playing repertoire, like classical repertoire. But no, it was actually things that he wrote. And it just sounded like he meshed it into like the classical repertoire so well because he knew it. He studied it so hard. And he's only like 19 at this point.
And he was studying by himself, right?
For the most part, yeah. He took lessons with somebody, but not all the time because, you know, to get that piano and take lessons, like, that's a lot of money. So, but that's
amazing.
Yeah. After high school, he went to the Pittsburgh Musical Institute for about a year, but when his teacher died, he left because he didn't think there was anyone else there who could teach him. Like, no one else was worthy, which reminds me of Ethel Smyth at the Leipzig Conservatory, who, like, left because she was, like, not good enough.
Yeah.
Billy was like, no, there was only one guy who was good enough, and now he's gone, so I'm a peace out. So he's living his life. He's, after high school, he's just working and making music on his own as much as he can. He even wrote and was a part of the production of a musical that they staged at the high school, but, like, for non-high school students, it was like adults, young 20s adults, and he wrote the music and it was like fantastic. Everybody loved it. So he's done all that, but in his early 20s he was introduced to jazz. So as you like learned before, he couldn't get into classical music for like conservatories and universities and stuff because nobody wanted a black concert piano player. So when a couple of his friends showed him jazz, he fell in love with it. His friend who showed him this Art Tatum record said, "What he realized we talked about was that everything he loved about classical music was there in one form or another, in jazz. And here was a place he could apply himself. Art Tatum was black. Teddy Wilson was black. And they were serious musicians like Strayhorn saw himself."
Mm.
So I think this is so important because not only is like the representation here important, where Billy was like, oh, people who look like me and they're working really hard and they're respected, so that's something that I am allowed to do, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, first of all that. Second of all, there, like, I'm sure that you're very well aware of like the difference between how classical music and jazz is like treated by classical musicians. Like, there's this kind of idea that like classical music is better because it's more elite and jazz is for the people. And you know, this idea came from racism primarily because it was like rich white people who do classical music and any black person who did jazz. At least that was like the public image. And so we don't always think of jazz as like worse, but we definitely, there's more cultural weight given to classical music versus jazz because of how elite we think it is.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, this quote that I read, I think, kind of encapsulates two major reasons why it's great. Because of representation for people of color who get locked out of classical music. And for its, like, objectively very high-quality music.
Yeah.
So he gets introduced to jazz, and I want to talk so much about Billy Strayhorn and his childhood and upbringing and stuff, but we don't have enough time. We've already talked for forever. So I'm going to go ahead and skip to the most pivotal moment in his career, which is when he meets Duke Ellington.
Ooh.
So he met Duke Ellington through a friend of a friend whose dad owned a club that many jazz guys played at frequently. And this friend of a friend almost introduced him to Count Basie, but Duke Ellington was there first. So it's crazy just, you know, how history, like, could have changed. Like, Count Basie was going to be there the next week, but the friend was like, I might as well just do it tonight.
Right.
Yeah. So here's the story of how Billy met Duke Ellington. Duke Ellington's band had a show, and Billy watched the show and afterwards came backstage to be introduced, and Duke Ellington was getting his hair done. So here's a long quote from the book. "I introduced Billy and we stood there," said Greenlee. Duke didn't get up. He didn't even open his eyes. He just said, "Sit down at the piano and let me hear what you can do." Strayhorn lowered himself onto the bench with calibrated grace and turned towards Ellington, who was lying still. "Mr. Ellington, this is the way you played this number on the show," Strayhorn announced, and began to perform his host's melancholy ballad, Sophisticated Lady, one of a few Ellington tunes Strayhorn knew from his days with the Mad Hatters. "The amazing thing was," explained Greenlee, "Billy played it exactly like Duke had just played it on stage. He copied him to perfection." Ellington stayed silent and prone, though his hair work was over. "Now, this is the way I would play it," continued Strayhorn. Changing keys and upping the tempo slightly, he shifted into an adaptation Greenlee described as pretty hip-sounding and further out there as he went on. At the end of the number, Strayhorn turned to Ellington, now standing right behind him, glaring at the keyboard over his shoulders. "Well," proceeded Ellington dramatically as he faced Strayhorn eye to eye for the first time, Ellington gazing down, Strayhorn peering up. "Can you do that again?" Isn't that a nice quote?
That is a nice quote.
Yeah. And so that was pretty much it. Duke Ellington was like, this kid is great. He's really good at what he does. He wanted him in his organization, but he didn't have a job for him. Like, he had an arranger, he had a piano player, all that kind of stuff. So he was like, all right, I'm going to be gone for a month, but I'm going to think about how to add you into my group. And then he, like, jotted down directions to his apartment in New York and left. And then Billy didn't hear from him for ever. So, a month passed, and Billy, like, you know when you are faced with, like, a decision, and you start asking all your friends, like, should I do this? But, like, I don't really know, but, like, should I do it? And the answer is yes, but you, like, ask everyone anyway.
You mean, like, our whole relationship?
Yeah. Yeah, like, when I was like, should I text Sam before we started dating? And you were like, do it.
I was like, do it. I was so aggressive. I was like, I swear I'm going to take your phone and text her for you.
Yeah. But anyway, so Billy was doing that with this Duke Ellington situation. He was like, but should I like work for him? Like, I don't even know. Like, I haven't heard from him. Like, is this a thing that I want to do? And I don't know. So eventually he decides, yes, he's going to. And he's like, all right, I'm just going to go to him. So he takes the directions to his apartment in New York. And he just goes there. And he was like, you know what? I'm going to impress him and I'm going to write a new jazz chart using the directions to his apartment as the inspiration for the lyrics. And that's where we get Take the A Train.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Yeah. So literally he said he like the tune and the words and stuff came to him faster than the actual train did. So this literal iconic piece of jazz music just was like a like almost a whim, you know, just a whim in the fancy head of Billy Strayhorn.
That's
our
amazing.
Child genius. Yeah. I think I didn't mention he was only like 23 when he met Duke Ellington.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Can
so
you imagine,
anyway,
like going to a flute lesson and being like, I'm gonna write a completely new sonata.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll do it. And then you get there and you're like, listen to this new piece I wrote on the way here.
Yeah. I know. I can't believe like this dude had the audacity to be the best, and he really did it.
If you want to find out about classical queers, then you're in the right place with Alice and Jaheed.
We're back. So we had a technical difficulty, well, a few of them, oh my god, Rosie, I'm sorry, give me a second, she just knocked something over. Rosie, oh my god.
Rosie girl, the kitten.
Wow, this cat. Anyway, let me try that again. We're back! We just had a few technical difficulties, and a couple days later, here we are again after our break. So we're just gonna pick up back where we were before.
Master procrastinators.
Yeah!
Hot mess.
I don't think we've addressed this before, but Shahid and I have a... What would you call it? Like an alter ego, or more just like a band, or...
I would, oh my god, can it please be a band?
A band, okay, we have a band.
It's definitely a band.
We have a band named Hot Mess, because that's who we are, and we've performed at 2 open mic nights at a bookstore, and...
We're famous.
Yeah, we're famous, they love us, and it's notoriously terrible, like I forget the words constantly to songs that we do. Anyway, so when we say that we're Hot Mess, like we are Hot Mess, we're not a Hot Mess, we're... Hot Mess.
We are literally hot. That's our band name.
Yeah, Hot Mess.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's super on brand for us to record over, like, several days because we procrastinated too much. Yeah. Anyway, so picking back up where we left off with Billy Strayhorn, he just met Duke Ellington for the first time, and Duke Ellington never reached out after he met him for the first time, even though he said he wanted to work with him. So Billy, he wrote Take the A Train, he showed up in New York, and Duke Ellington and his orchestra were playing a show. Billy gets brought to the show, gets taken backstage, and Duke Ellington is like, I was going to get in touch with you. And Billy says, well, here I am. And that was it. From then on, Billy was just a part of the organization. So he got to move to New York, which was pretty much all that he wanted. You know, he got to become like the New York socialite that he always was really meant to be, you know, that he wasn't able to be in Pittsburgh.
God, don't we all want to be New York socialites?
Right? Oh, my God. So he goes there. He was originally put up in a room at the Y, like the YMCA, which in the 30s was, I guess, a place where you could live. I don't know anything about the YMCA.
Whoa.
But yeah.
I thought it was just like a gym.
You know, I don't really know. There's like more stuff there also. But anyway, so he originally gets put up in a room there, and Duke Ellington is paying for his food, his board, his whatever, you know, everything he needs. But the room was kind of like not great. There was a ton of like common spaces with a bunch of random strangers, and it wasn't like a good room and stuff. So he spent one night there. And the next night, he basically just moves himself into Duke Ellington's home. So here's how he does it. Duke Ellington has an apartment, like a penthouse apartment, with his sister, Ruth Ellington, his lover, whose name was, I don't remember what her name was, but she was there, Mildred, I think, and his son, Mercer Ellington. But Duke was usually not there. He was often, like, elsewhere on tour and whatever. So Mercer Ellington tells the story. He says, Strayhorn said that he would like to talk because he wanted to know about Duke Ellington. So he came to the house the night after he stayed at the Y and had dinner with my aunt and I. The result was that he stayed, we chatted and played records and all that kind of stuff. And when the time came for us to go to bed, we said, well, I guess we'll go to sleep. And I got up to go to my room. And Strayhorn says, well, I'll just lay here. And Ruth went to her room, and that was it. He literally just was like, I live here now. And they were like, yeah,
move.
I know. So I love that a lot. He stayed there for almost a whole year. And they just, you know, they loved it. Duke Ellington was already paying for his everything. So it wasn't even like a big deal.
Did he just stay like in the like main living room?
I think they had an extra room. It was a big apartment.
They had an extra room in the penthouse in New York City.
Yeah, the New York City penthouse. Yeah.
Can you imagine, oh, I guess you can stay in the extra room.
I know, and it's not even like a burden. But yeah, so Billy Strayhorn lived there, and they loved it. The two ladies who lived there, Ruth, who was actually Billy's age, not she wasn't as old as Duke Ellington, and the lover, whose name, again, I'm pretty sure is Mildred. I don't know why I didn't write that down. They loved him. He, like, helped out. He was smart and kind and polite. Yeah. So when it came to Billy's role in the organization, he didn't have any sort of, like, there was no agreement. There was no formal agreement about what his responsibilities were, what he was going to be paid, all that kind of stuff. It was just kind of like, you're here and you'll do what I tell you to do when I tell you to do it. And Billy's like, I don't know, whatever. So he starts doing work kind of sporadically as Duke Ellington requests it. Duke Ellington would be like, hey, I need you to arrange these two charts for the group that I've got. And then Billy would be like, all right, I need to give it to him the next day. And Duke Ellington was like, excellent. And then this would happen just like kind of like every couple of weeks. But you know, things started getting more and more and more. And it became clear that Billy Strayhorn was, like, really good at his job. So essentially, Billy Strayhorn was, like, an arranger, composer, orchestrator for Duke Ellington and his band. Billy Strayhorn is the cream of the crop. He's so good at what he does, and he's happy doing all of this work at a really high level. And so, because he's happy doing things that he wants to do, it could have been really easy for him to overlook the fact that Ellington's name had been added as co-composer to many of the songs that Billy Strayhorn wrote and that were later recorded. So this is the beginning of a long line of Duke Ellington kind of taking credit for the things that Billy Strayhorn did. So we'll get more onto that later. But in the meantime, it's time for love.
Ooh.
So towards, within the first year of Billy living in New York, Mercer Ellington, Duke's son, introduced Billy to a friend of his named Aaron Bridgers. All he said was that, like, I don't know, I felt like that they should meet. But they were both black, gay piano players. So I guess he was like, they just gotta go together.
As people do.
Yeah. Yeah. In reading about them on the internet, you'd think, you know, people mention Billy Strayhorn's first, like, lover or partner or whatever, Aaron Bridgers, and you think of them as just, like, recluse men. But no, at the time when they met, Billy was 24 and Aaron was 21. Those are babies.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm a baby now. That's how old I am. I'm a baby. They were babies. So, like, they were just two young kids who met in New York and fell in love. And it was really sweet. They just kind of, and they were, among the people that they were with, just accepted. It was kind of like, Billy and Aaron, they're together. That's how it is. Which was super great in, you know, 1930s New York, which is, mm-hmm. you know, amazing. Amazing. You love to see it.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's awesome.
Yeah, and at this point, so, very quickly, they moved in together, Aaron and Billy, and they joined up in, like, circles of friends that were primarily, like, black people and gay people. They didn't totally overlap. There were straight people, there were white people, but mostly other black gay folks, and they got to hang out together in, like, posh fancy clubs that played good music all the time, and Billy got to start to live the New York socialite life he always wanted to do.
What a dream.
Yeah. In the book, the author wrote, Strayhorn didn't so much transform in New York as take form. In New York, his amorphous youthful idea of urban Elon, don't know what that word means, could finally be made real. His sister said, he had always had a certain vision of himself, but it never had a chance to come out until he went to New York and met the right people and went to the right places. Then he really came alive. Rosie, did you hear that?
I did.
Okay, I'm gonna go let her out real quick. Pardon me. Rosie.
Rosarito. Roselia.
So, anyway. back to Billy. Thanks, Rosie, for the interlude. Working with Duke Ellington made Billy safe, you know, and part of the reason he was able to be so free and so fully himself in New York was because he knew that he had, like, somebody like Duke Ellington, who was famous and well-known and well-loved and well-respected, on his side all the time. Once again, according to the book, this support was priceless to Strayhorn, according to his intimates, particularly after his frustrations with prejudice during his early career in Pittsburgh. With Duke, Billy said he had security, remarked George Greenlee. Duke didn't question his manliness. It wasn't like that for him back home. So, and this is, you know, that's just priceless, especially at the time. And even now, something like that now is just so important.
You know what? This is, like, also, I feel like this is such a safe place because this is the second episode now that we've had this sort of conversation where, like, someone was safe within their music.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, I feel like that's true for a lot of artists. Like, when they are, like, really within their art, like, people don't care, like, about, anything about their identity. I mean, they do, obviously, they do care, but it's more like, it's not important as much as their art. Like, their art overcomes, like, it, like, dominates any prejudice that is there.
Yeah.
It's like, I don't care who you are. Like, yeah. You can play.
Yeah.
That's what I admire about you.
Yeah, definitely. It's really beautiful, you know, and that's one of the many reasons why music is so important. Now we gotta keep it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think I've definitely felt that way as well, like, secure. Like, when I'm around, like, other musicians, like, oh, I feel comfortable here. Like, I don't feel insecure about, like, my identity because I feel like I'm being questioned when I'm around those certain environments.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that's so beautiful. The book also said this: Billy could have pursued a career on his own. He had the talent to become rich and famous, but he'd have to be less than honest about his sexual orientation. Or he could work behind the scenes for Duke and be open about being gay.
Hmm.
Yeah, again, it's like he had more of an ultimatum, I guess, at the time, than you or I do. But I feel like for the most part, he really flourished. He really had more freedom than a lot of people did,
mm-hmm.
which is so beautiful. And so,
that is.
Yeah, and it's really, it makes me feel so happy that some, like, a black gay man, which even today is some, like, somebody who is just not respected enough by the law, by society, a black gay man in the 1930s was given the freedom, the like, financial freedom, the artistic freedom, the personal freedom to be exactly who he was and do the work that he wanted to do at such a high level. It just makes me so happy, like, thinking about Billy Strayhorn just, like, going around nightclubs and, like, singing and playing for his friends, you know?
Yeah.
You know, just being free and being happy. It just makes me so, yeah, it makes me so happy.
It's very heartwarming, yeah, and makes me feel very happy as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, anyway, as for the relationship between the composer and arranger, as Duke Ellington to Billy Strayhorn, Strayhorn himself said that Ellington's only piece of advice was unfettering. His first, last, and only formal instruction for me was embodied in one word: observe. The two of them would rarely discuss projects in detail. Ruth Ellington, Duke's sister, said, and I love this quote, you'll see, I'd see Billy walk into Duke's dressing room, and Duke would say, "Oh, Billy, I want you to finish this thing for me." Just like that, "I want you to finish this thing for me." And Billy would sit and stare into his eyes for about 10 minutes, and Duke would stare back, and then Billy would say, "Okay." And they wouldn't even exchange a word, they'd just look into each other's eyes, and Billy would go out and write what Duke wanted.
What?
Right? Isn't that so wild? Just imagine that. You know, you're sitting in your apartment, you're Ruth Ellington, and then Duke walks in and is like, "Billy, I want you to write this thing for me." And Billy says, "Okay." And then he does it. Can't stand it. As an artist and as a person, according to the book, Duke Ellington resisted completion. As long as something is unfinished, he said, Rosie.
He said,
oh my god. As long as something is unfinished, there's always that little feeling of insecurity. And a feeling of insecurity is absolutely necessary, unless you're so rich it doesn't matter. According to the book, with Strayhorn on hand, Ellington can keep that insecurity and gain the security of knowing that something he dropped could not only be finished, but possibly improved. And so, why do we say improved? Well, Billy Strayhorn was somebody who not only could mimic Duke Ellington's style completely, like, he could totally chameleon himself into it, but he also had his own style, and, like, when he decided he wanted to use it, he did, completely. And it was, he had his own voice, and it showed every time he wanted it to. Here's this quote from a friend of his from Pittsburgh, who was talking about, like, what made his music so good. Strayhorn went through a lot of shit in his life, from his father right on through school. The kids calling him a sissy, you know. He kept it all in and put on a big front that everything was fine, nothing bothered him. Then he sat down and all his feelings came out in the music. That's what made his stuff so incredible and different from Duke's. It was great music, like Duke's was, and it was so full of dark feeling. So he wasn't just an assistant or their writing and arranging companion, as Ellington referred to him on stage. He was a critical part of the equation. Here's another quote. I'm just going to be reading quotes all day. The misconception was that Ellington put Strayhorn there because Billy knew what Duke would do. The truth was the opposite. Ellington put Billy there to do what Billy wanted because Duke knew that whatever Billy did would be great. However, resentment slowly began to build because Duke Ellington was taking all the credit for a lot of Billy Strayhorn's work. Here's a couple examples of this. Billy Strayhorn and this other random dude had collaborated on a 44-page booklet on Duke Ellington's instrumental approach, which was called Duke Ellington Piano Method for Blues, and the only author that was credited was Duke Ellington, who didn't actually do it.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then a bunch of other, like, I read a list of a bunch of songs that Billy Strayhorn wrote that the composer was listed as Duke Ellington only. Sometimes Duke Ellington's name was added to things that Billy did, so it had both of them, even though Duke didn't do anything. And it was really, you know, it just happened all the time. What was interesting about this, there's a few things that's interesting about this. One is that it's a complicated situation because Billy Strayhorn did not receive the royalties for all these songs that he wasn't credited on. However, Duke Ellington published all these through his own company, which he gave Billy a significant share of stocks in. So Billy was making money from all of the compositions, basically, but not, like, specifically the ones from himself. Rosie! She's also upset about copyright infringement. I'm gonna go let her out. Rosie.
Be free, young one. Rosetta Stone. Rosario.
Okay, I'm back. Do you think that Rosie is too much of an interruption, or should I just leave her in?
No, she's absolutely a co-host.
Okay, you're right. She's the third host of Classical Queeros.
Yes.
Yeah.
She is Classical Queeros.
She is the Classical Queero. So anyway, yeah, so it was complicated for that reason, and it was also complicated because Duke Ellington had experienced the same thing that he was doing to Billy Strayhorn. According to the novel, publishing mogul Irving Mills took credit for co-composing or writing lyrics and took the related royalties for more than 50 Ellington works. Fortunately for Ellington, no one really thought Mills wrote anything. Strayhorn's case was more complex since his responsibilities in the Ellington organization included aiding Ellington in both refining and completing works clearly conceived as Ellington music. So, like, it just baffles me that Duke Ellington did that. But at the same time, you know, he paid for everything that Billy needed and gave him all this extra money as shares in his company, his publishing company. So it's kind of like, like, he took care of him. He made sure that he didn't want for anything. But this one particular thing was, you know, lacking. And the problem that Billy had with Duke Ellington taking all this credit wasn't a financial problem or a legal problem. It was a personal artistic problem. Because if Duke Ellington had all the copyrights and the royalties for all these songs that Billy wrote, then what independence did he have? He felt like, you know, he didn't have the rights to his songs. And, like, he didn't care about the credit, really. It wasn't about, like, other people knowing. It was more about, like having the agency to do things on his own. So, like, if it weren't for Duke Ellington, Billy wouldn't have any of this, you know? So it was a whole thing. So more examples of how Duke Ellington got credit for things Billy did. There was a Broadway-esque show. I actually don't remember if this one was on Broadway itself that Duke Ellington signed on to, like, work on, but Billy did most of the work. And here are two reviews. This one is from the New York World Telegrams. He said, "Mr. Ellington's score is a generous outpouring of his individual talent, filled with the spirit and the warmth of his music, the pulsing beat of his rhythms, the strength and the refreshing colors of his modern harmonies." Not a word about Billy. And the New York Times said, "Mr. Ellington has been dashing off songs with remarkable virtuosity. No conventional composer, he has not written a pattern of song hits to be lifted out of their context, but rather an integral musical composition that carries the old, gay, picaresque yarn through its dark modern setting." And the only mention of Billy in the program for this show said, "Orchestrations under the personal supervision of Billy Strayhorn." Meanwhile, he actually, like, wrote most of the songs himself, with little to no assistance from Duke Ellington himself. And so this thing just happened all the time.
It's like Ratatouille.
Like Ratatouille?
Wait. Yeah, because, like, Remy's, like, doing all the cooking.
Oh my god.
But
oh my god, so Remy is Billy Strayhorn and Linguini is Duke Ellington?
Yeah.
I can't.
That's like the same thing, right? Like, oh, let me take you in. Like, you weren't respected at your old house. There was a grandma trying to shoot you.
There's a grandma trying to shoot you. You know.
You can live here. You can use my ingredients.
Oh my god. I think you're right, because, like, at first, Linguini is, like, he's there to help the rat, but also, the rat, his name is Remy, oh my god. He's there to help Remy, but then afterwards he gets selfish and he doesn't want to, like, let anybody know that it's not him doing the work. Whoa. I can't believe Ratatouille stole from the real life of Billy Strayhorn.
It's literally Ratatouille. Oh my wow. God. Okay.
I'm actually shook. Anyway, what I was going to say is there was a lot about, you know, often these things would happen where they would collaborate on things, but only Duke Ellington's name would be on the bill. And some of the reason is that, like, Duke Ellington and Billy Strayhorn wouldn't sell because Duke Ellington was the name and nobody knew who Billy Strayhorn was. So in order to get things to sell, like, it's a, you know, they kind of did what they had to do. And both Duke and Billy, they knew that. And it didn't seem to be a problem for a while, but, you know, after 20 years of this, it did.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I imagine it'll get old.
Yeah. So it did start to get old. At the opening night party of this show that I told you the reviews for, here's a quote from friend Oliver Smith, who was around. I think he was in the show. He said, "Billy didn't say boo about Duke or how the credits would read the whole time. But on opening night on Broadway, there's a grand gala party. Duke was there in all his splendor, receiving his public. Ellington moved among the first nighters in a disembodied glide that impressed the dancers. He acknowledged others with only a slow beginning of a nod of the head and never appeared to move the rest of his body, apparently powered by something outside himself. Billy said to me, 'Let's get out of here.' I said, 'But the party's just starting.' And he said, 'Not for me, it isn't.' I told him, 'No, I really should stay.' And he walked away and out of the theater alone." So that was the first time that people noticed that he started to have an issue with Duke Ellington taking credit for the things that he did. Soon afterwards, a good friend of his, Lena Horne, a singer who was, like, low-key to high-key in love with Billy, but knew that he was gay and didn't, like, push it, but she loved him so much. She got married.
Oh, no.
No, it's okay. It turns out fine. She got married to another guy who was just like him, but white. So Billy met him, and he was hanging out with them a lot, especially because Billy's partner, Aaron, at this point had moved to Paris and was staying there for the foreseeable future. And so it was pretty ambiguous about if they broke up or if they were long distance, but it was, you know, it was still pretty sad. So let's just consider them broken up at this point, I guess. This is like the mid-40s, early 50s, around there. So the guy that his friend Lena Horne married, his name was Hayton. That was his last name. This guy, Hayton, had been exploring the prospect of developing his own music production and publishing company and had asked Strayhorn about his agreement with Ellington. And then he finds out that they didn't have an agreement, and Billy had no idea how much his arrangements and compositions might be worth on the open market, and he told Billy to be more attentive to the business side of his career with Ellington. According to Mercer Ellington, that was the beginning of problems with Strayhorn. Lena and Hayton really took him under their wing, and because Aaron was away in Paris, they got a lot more of his attention than Pop, his dad, Duke Ellington. We didn't see very much of Strayhorn for a while. And at this time, also, Billy had a piece that he loved. He wrote a song called Lush Life, way early in his career while he was still in Pittsburgh. And he never published it, he never performed it, he only played it at little parties. By pure coincidence, he happened to be playing it in a recording studio when Nat King Cole walked in, and he was like, "I want to do that." So a while later, he releases Billy's song Lush Life, which was like his baby, you know, this song. But this guy Pete Ruggolo wrote the orchestral arrangement of the cover and took huge liberties with it. He just, like, turned it around, messed it up, changed lyrics so that they didn't even make sense, and messed up the harmony. Billy called Aaron Bridgers all the way out in Paris and was very upset with it. Aaron had never seen him this upset before or after. But he also thinks that it probably affected him more than it would have earlier in his life because he was already upset about Duke Ellington taking credit for his work, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So around this time, Billy gets sent to Paris to work on another like Broadway-esque production under Duke Ellington's name, but it ended up being a real hot mess. Like, not a Shahid and Alice hot mess, but, like, a hot mess. And it was awful. And all the music that Billy worked so hard on just kept getting pushed to the side until he was just, like, miserable in a corner. So he leaves that. He's feeling awful. He also had seen Aaron, again, in Paris, but Aaron was, like, getting set up to stay permanently, so it was must have been, like, a kind of a goodbye. But he started going to these things called Neil Salon sessions. So what that is there started to be this, like, inner circle of artists in New York who were primarily Black, but not everybody. Who just, like, they knew each other and they would just all gather at the home of these people whose last name was Neil. And they called it the Neil Salon because they were being fancy. And they would just, like, host each other and discuss their art in their various forms. It was super cool. People like Eartha Kitt and John Cage would show up and just, like, hang out. And because it was so wholesome, it was, like, it was just a bunch of people trying to support each other. One of the Neils, in fact, said, "We were all daring to try to have careers in an arena where everything was structured against the possibility of having a career." So it was super, like, wholesome and good for not just Billy, but everybody there to have a bunch of people there who were trying to do the same thing, to try to work really hard, even though, like, white capitalism doesn't want that. They don't want successful Black people and all that jazz. Oh my God, jazz. And so Billy gained a lot more self-confidence from going to these sessions. He said to himself afterwards, "You know what? There are some things that I want to do for myself for a change. I think I'm going to do them." So he really did. After about 14 years of duetting with Ellington figuratively, literally, publicly, or secretly, Billy Strayhorn made his first steps out of Ellington's sphere of influence in mid-1953. So they met in the late 1930s. And in 1953 is when Billy Strayhorn decides he's going to do something for himself. Now, unfortunately, I'm not going to talk about any of that because we don't have enough time. And Billy Strayhorn lived a rich life. So I'm going to skip forward about a decade. Just know that in the 50s, he did go out and do projects for himself that were, like, you know, all right received. But ultimately, he did stay with Duke Ellington and his orchestra. And in interviews afterwards... and especially after these copyright debacles, Billy never said anything bad about Duke Ellington. He only praised his artistic talents and, you know, he was like, he's a good guy, and we'll just leave it at that. So, in the 60s, Billy met Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. through some friends. And this is great. We love that. They'd talk about civil rights passionately for ages at parties together. They'd just sit in the kitchen and just, like, look at each other and just, like, keep going and going and going and going about, like, civil rights, and they were just so, like, in it. And Billy was super involved in the civil rights movement. He helped organize and march and fight, and he was just really passionate about it. He also had a lot of empathy for many sides. Lena Horne, his friend, who married that other guy who helped him with the copyright stuff, her husband was white, but she was Black, and Black people often thought she was too white, kind of because of that and kind of how she kind of conducted herself. So she was really quiet about civil rights things. But it was Billy who encouraged her to begin speaking out. She said, "Billy was the source of my consciousness raising, not about being Black, but about being me. I had to learn to accept myself first, and that's what Billy helped me to do. He knew that I had to expose myself. He knew I had to be unafraid." So, bolstered by Strayhorn, Lena decided to undertake her first initiative of public acclamation for Black rights early in 1963. He said he'd go with me, and he helped me make the plans. So, yeah, he took her to this huge protest in Jackson, Mississippi, and they asked her to sing, and she was like, "I don't know," and he just said yes for her, and he taught her everything she needed to know, and he squeezed her hand before she walked on stage, and then she sang Amazing Grace for 2,000 people, and it was amazing. And this time period was so good for him because he, like, you know, loved having a really, really worthy, important cause to fight for. And, you know, I love hearing about this because not only is he, like, a great person and musician, but he's also, like, passionate about other people and about the cause and about civil rights, which is, like, Ethel Smythe, our good friend from two episodes ago. She was out here living her life, being the best at being a Victorian lesbian composer, and she was also fighting for the right for women to vote. So we love to see people fighting for people.
Yeah.
Could I have put that better? Maybe. But yeah, so In late 1963, Duke Ellington and his orchestra were sent by President Kennedy to tour the Near and Middle East as a sort of diplomacy tour thing. While performing in Baghdad, a military coup began and bombs started raining down on a government building only a few hundred yards from the concert.
Whoa.
So they all were told to go shelter in place in their hotel room, and they're like freaking out, but they're okay. But basically they kind of get used to this kind of thing, this kind of unrest. Later in Turkey, they're at a diplomatic dinner when someone runs in and shouts, "The president's been shot." And they're like, "Everyone's getting shot. It's fine." And he's like, "No, no, no. Our president has been shot." So that was the day that President John F. Kennedy was assassinated. So the tour is canceled immediately and everyone goes home. Duke Ellington, whoa, who was a self-proclaimed hypochondriac, he apparently did not deal well with death, his own or anyone else's. So he did not deal well with Kennedy's assassination at all. He just like didn't deal with it. He just was like, okay, I'm gonna put this in a box and never look at it. And this is foreshadowing. What was that sound my mouth just made? Did you hear that?
I did.
Was it weird?
It was weird. It didn't sound like it came from you. It sounded like it came from the back of the room.
It felt like it came from somewhere else. That was weird. Anyway, so in early 1964, Billy is diagnosed with cancer of the esophagus. It was a close friend of his, a doctor, who diagnosed him. And when he told Billy, Billy seemed resigned and just kind of ready to accept it. Duke Ellington, however, was not okay. When the doctor called Duke Ellington, he said, "What kind of doctor are you? Why didn't you see this coming? Do you know what you're saying?" He just wasn't okay, which is, you know, wild. But it really shows you how important Billy was to Duke Ellington. They were really, like, deeply important to each other. We don't know how Duke and Billy talked about it together, though, how they reacted to one another. That's just something that we'll never find out. In the last few years of his life, Billy got a lot more serious in his work, in his personal life. There was a lot less laughter, and he tolerated a lot less, you know, things he didn't want. So he pretty much just did what he wanted to do, whether it was like a project or something he wanted to learn or people he wanted to hang out with, and he didn't really do anything else. Later in that year of 1964, Billy began a relationship with a white man named Bill Grove, who was very quiet and very meticulous. And close friends said that this guy, Bill Grove, was pretty much just what Billy needed at the time. Somebody who was quiet and would listen to the things that Billy said. Soon afterwards, he was offered an opportunity to play a solo concert for the first time, like, pretty much ever, by a society of Duke Ellington fanatics. But he was like, "I don't know. I mean, why would anyone come to see me? They just want to hear Duke Ellington. They don't want to hear me. Who am I?" But they reassured him that they're like, "No, no, no, no. We love you. Like, people love you, especially people who know and understand Duke Ellington. Like, you are loved and respected. We love you, the things that you do." And eventually he was like, "You know what? Okay, I'll do it." And he planned a program full of his own compositions, and it was a huge hit, and people really, like, saw that he wasn't just a Duke Ellington clone or chameleon. He was Billy Strayhorn. His condition worsened over the next few years. He got sicker and sicker, and his friends started just taking care of him and taking him on, like, last trips. While Billy was in the hospital at one point, Duke Ellington put together a musical gift for him, including, like, tape recordings of a bunch of friends, including piano players from France. From France? Including piano players from Paris, some of whom were Aaron Bridgers, Billy's first love, and Claude Bowling. So there's a little hashtag flute fact. Anyway, in the early morning of May 31st, 1967, Billy Strayhorn died at the age of 51 with Bill Grove by his side. Duke Ellington, when he found out, he just cried and cried and cried. Is what happened. He wasn't okay. And understandably so, Billy Strayhorn was a remarkable influence on him. In fact, during the last few years of Billy's life, Duke Ellington's music started becoming a little bit more religious. And a big part of that was that Duke Ellington had to... He was faced with mortality in the form of Billy, his friend, dying, and he was like, oh my god, how could this happen to Billy? And then he was like, oh my god, this could happen to me. And so that turned his entire musical path towards something different. So in that way, and in many, many other ways, Billy Strayhorn was one of the biggest influences on Duke Ellington as a man and as a musician.
Mm.
A year after his death, friends scattered his ashes in a river nearby in New York. Duke Ellington silently watched from a distance. And it was appropriate that he would honor Strayhorn in anonymity, the way that he often honored Strayhorn himself in his real life. So, yeah. That's it. That's the life of Billy Strayhorn. I wish we could have talked about so many more things. I loved the book that I read. It's called Lush Life. No, sorry. It's called A Lush Life. And that's where I got pretty much all the information, because the internet is not helpful when it comes to composers who are not that well known. But yeah, so Billy Strayhorn, know the name, appreciate the name, we love him.
Wow. Yeah. Thank you for sharing that knowledge with us.
Yeah.
So much interesting thing. I had no idea about any of this. Like,
yeah. You know,
I knew the name, you know, mm-hmm. I associated it with Ellington.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh yeah, the dude that worked with Ellington.
Yeah. But yeah, he was, you know, he had a whole life and it was just phenomenal. And I really respect him. And I'm so glad that I know more about him. Recommended listenings would include, like, most of songs that we know as Duke Ellington tunes, like Take the A Train, Chelsea Bridge is by Billy Strayhorn, All Heart is something that they did with Ella Fitzgerald. You know, Billy Strayhorn wrote so many things, and he also wrote a lot of things that we're just never gonna see because the music was just not saved over time. Like a lot of the musicals that he did, and you know, other musical reviews, and just so much. He was incredibly prolific. Like, we talk about Haydn writing 111 symphonies, but nobody talks about Billy Strayhorn, who just would write things overnight and it already be perfect. He was somebody who understood every part of a rehearsal and could change things in the music to make it easier for everyone else, because he just already understood everybody's strengths and weaknesses, like, right off the bat. And he never made anybody he was rehearsing with feel uncomfortable, because he knew them, he understood them, he valued them, and he treated them with respect.
Hmm.
Yeah. So I love Billy Strayhorn. There, I said it.
We all do here.
We all love Billy Strayhorn.
Classical queeros.
You, me, and Rosie. We all love Billy Strayhorn.
And our listeners. Did we ever come up with a listener name?
I think queeros.
Is queeros an okay listener name?
Yeah, like our... Well, I mean, it's like, it's confusing because it's the name of the people we talk about, and it's also our listeners, but I feel like it's fine. Like, if I were listening to this, I would want to be called a queero, right?
If you were a straight woman.
I would never be a straight woman. Don't even say that.
That's true. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I'm really glad I learned about Billy Strayhorn.
Yeah.
And I'm really happy. I really liked learning about how, like, he fit in really well within his, like, group
mm-hmm.
in New York City. Yeah. And how he, like, found love.
Yeah.
And was, like, you know, comfortable, like, that is nice.
Yeah.
Like, I wouldn't have expected that.
Right?
From the time.
Yeah. Yeah. He died in 1967. And, like, we don't associate gay people or black people having any sort of rights from the times before that. So it's remarkably refreshing to read a story where he wasn't just, like, faced with persecution his entire life.
Yeah.
You know? And that's why I think representation is so important, because if we think that, you know, people of color, queer people, if the only option for us that we've seen historically is persecution and ostracization, then it's hard to believe that we're allowed to have freedom now, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, his story just makes me so happy in a level that I don't know how to describe, really.
I love it.
Yeah. Well, I guess that's our episode.
That's the episode.
Yay! Make sure to follow us on Instagram at Classical Queeros or Twitter at Classical Queero. And make sure to support your local gays and your local gays of color, especially. And
support queer black artists, please.
Yeah. And is there anything else?
And catch our next episode.
Yeah, and catch our next episode. Okay, bye.
Bye. If you want to find out about Rosie's poops, then you're in the right place in Alice's room.